From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capitol Notes podcast for Friday, November 12th. I'm John Myers from KQED and the California Report. And a bit of, a different podcast for you faithful podcast listeners this week. Scheduling, of course, is always challenging when you're a full-time journalist and your colleague on this podcast is also a full-time journalist doing multiple things at once. I'm actually going to be at a State House Reporters Conference, a conference for reporters who cover state houses all across the country here at the end of the week. And so we weren't able to sit down and do our normal studio chat. So I thought what we would do instead is give you something that some of you have heard before, but I think is especially timely now. And that's a sit-down conversation I had with Jerry Brown, the now governor-elect of California. But the conversation happened back right after he announced that he was running for governor again this spring. And it was really the only sit-down conversation that I've had with the governor-elect since this campaign began. It should be noted that during the campaign and right before Election Day, his campaign declined to make time for Brown to sit down to do an interview for the California Report again. Meg Whitman did do a sit-down interview right before the election on November 2nd, and so we weren't able to bring him back to the audience the same way we had talked to her. But I think when you go back and you listen to this conversation that I had with Brown back in the spring, you hear a lot again about how he's approaching this job. And I think that is very instructive, especially since on Wednesday we saw those numbers, as many of you know from the legislative analyst, that the state faces a $25.4 billion deficit when Brown takes office. $6 billion of that in the current fiscal year that ends on July 1st, about $19 billion in the fiscal year that Brown will have to deal with when he proposes a budget in January. So here's my conversation with Jerry Brown from this spring. And again, we'll try to be back to our normal smart alecky selves in the studio next week for a podcast.
You seem to be hesitant about running in a lot of the public comments. And I'm just wondering, if in fact you were hesitant, is there anything in particular that you saw that you just said, I got to get in there and fix this? I mean, what made you do it?
Well, I certainly didn't rush in. And anyone who understands the depth of the problems of state government would not rush in. I think back to that saying, angels fear to tread where fools rush in. But I am in now, and I've given it a great deal of thought. And what I conclude is that my preparation, my understanding, and the skills that I've developed over a lifetime is precisely what's needed to knock heads together, to forge the common undertaking that now is required by California government. We have Republicans and Democrats. We've got people of various regional interests, political stripes of one kind or another. We got to pull together. It's not who caused this mess. It's here. Part of it's Wall Street. Part of it's overspending by state officials. But it's here. And we need several years to climb out of the mess. We need collaboration. It's not about dictating a solution. It's about leading people and working with them as Californians first, members of a political party second.
In the video announcement you made announcing your candidacy, you said you have an outsider's mind. And I'm wondering, what does that mean to you? I mean, some people might think it's a nod to this reputation that you're unconventional. But what does it mean?
Well, I think back to my training as a Jesuit novice when I studied to be a Catholic priest. We were told to be in the world, but not of it. And I like to think that I've been in politics, but I'm not of it in the sense that I march to a different drummer. I understand philosophy. I've had a wide variety of experiences. I've lived in Japan for 6 months, Latin America for 5 months. I worked briefly with Mother Teresa in Calcutta at the Home for the Dying. And I've seen government from every angle. And that's given me, I believe, a real-world feeling about where government is in the grand scheme of things. So I appreciate it. I like to be a part of it. But I understand that's not all of life. And that's why I say I have insider's knowledge but an outsider's mind.
Obviously, California government, since we're talking about it, has got a lot of problems. I don't think there's any dispute about that. And the problems seem to have their roots that really stretch back through the years. I mean, no one thinks that we got into this mess overnight. There is some discussion as to whether those roots stretch back to your time as governor, and I wonder what you think about some of those analyses. I mean, people talk about that there might have been too little investment in higher education, too little investment in infrastructure. Any chance are there any of your fingerprints on any of those roots?
Well, that's an interesting question, because some of the Republican critics are saying, well, there wasn't enough money spent, as you say. And then the other hand, they say, wait a minute, you spent too much money. So there is an incoherence in the critique of my opponents.
But even not just Republicans. I mean, some people just who try to look at for the historical view of what was going on in the 70s.
Well, I did slow government spending from what the growth pattern under Ronald Reagan. There's no question. I was a frugal governor. I built up a rainy day fund, which was the largest surplus in the history of the state. And that $5 billion that I fought hard for against legislative efforts to spend was the real salvation after Proposition 13 cut two-thirds of the property tax in local government. So I helped the schools and the fire departments and the police departments because we had the money. Today, we have the opposite. We have a gaping hole, a gigantic deficit. And so the challenge now is to work with the legislators, not play the blame game, and in a collaborative way, but a very decisive forward movement, look at every aspect of the budget, engage every legislator, all 120, in groups as a whole, not with their staffs, but with them, at least part of the time, and then share it with the people, share it with the campaign influence people, whether it be big business or religious groups or unions, all the people that legislators listen to, they have to be part of the solution too. This state is in crisis, and we will emerge from it if we slow the spending and we encourage the job growth in the private sector, and then eventually the economy returns. We've had many recessions over the last 100 years. California has always come back stronger and more prosperous. When I was governor, 1.9 million jobs created in 8 years. We'll do it again, but it takes patience, it takes courage, and it takes collaboration.
A lot of discussion this week, as you've announced, about your evolution in politics, all the different things that you've done, the ways that you've approached the whole craft. I guess the question I wanted to ask you is, you know, the public sometimes is cynical about politics and about politicians. How does the public distinguish evolving as a politician might, as a lot of folks say you have, from somebody who sticks their finger in the wind and says, wherever you want to go, I'll go that way?
Well, that's a good question. I have a consistent record of fighting for the environment, fighting for workers' rights, taking the position in support of the underdog, and pioneering new ideas. As mayor of Oakland, just in recent times, I conceptualized the notion of 10,000 people, 10K, in the downtown. No one had ever dreamed that downtown Oakland was a neighborhood that middle-class people would like to move into, but we created that. No one dreamed in the 70s that solar energy or wind or even geothermal or efficiency could be a major source of our energy going forward. Yet California led the world. And so I have a consistency. Now, do I have to make adjustments? I do. I oppose Proposition 13. The people made it into law. My oath is to carry out the law, and I did. And I was able to implement what was a very tough measure, cutting property taxes two-thirds, take functionality that was in the local level and move it through the state with the money. And we did that. Now, today, we have to find ways of bringing back some of that power and responsibility to local government. That's part of the budget solution.
Well, Prop 13 is actually something I wanted to talk to you about, and it's going to get talked about a lot. There's no surprise to that. I noticed that you told one reporter in the beginning of this conversation this week that there's a unique factor to being in place at the beginning when something happens and now, and you can see how the policy has moved over time. No example to me covering government comes to mind more than Prop 13. Does Prop 13 work, looking at it from then and from now?
Well, Prop 13 does work. As a matter of fact, with the turnover in property, the property tax revenues have climbed significantly over the decades. And some people don't realize that, but that happens to be the fact. And We do need more stable revenue sources. That's a problem. The income tax is very volatile. But I believe that we can live within 13. I've certainly been able to do that. And it's going to take a lot of creativity.
Is it sacrosanct? I mean, should it not be touched no matter what? Well, because there are some people who say it has some unintended consequences.
It does, because it's migrated power up to the state level, and the state can't cope with all the diverse interests that are easier to confront at the local level, because there's more common experience in a city or a school district than there is in Sacramento, covering 400 cities, 58 counties, and 38 million people. So is it sacrosanct? I have to say there are no sacred cows. Everyone has regulation and laws that they like, but as Californians, we have to confront our crisis and make the best judgments we can, being ready to change where needed.
How about the notion that it protects commercial property rates the same way it does residential property rates, the notion that maybe you split that out?
It does that, and I would just say this, that we're not looking at taxes. We are looking at limiting our government spending within the money made available by the people, expecting that the growth in the economy will come back over time if we have the fiscal discipline, and to do that in a very public way so the public can weigh in. And there will be initiatives on the ballot, and people have a chance to vote yes or no. So it is never finished. Government is a continuous process of give and take and discussion among the legislators and among the voters.
The mirror of Prop 13, in a lot of ways, it seems like to me, is the school funding guarantee, Proposition 98. One of them cuts revenues, one of them mandates spending. Same kind of question. Prop 98, sacrosanct, need to be tweaked, works?
Everything needs to be tweaked. That's obvious. But I have to say that schools are not overfunded. Nobody can say that. And that's true of community colleges. It's true of high schools. It's true of grammar schools. So,
but
98.
I was going to say less that part than the fact that it requires a certain level of spending. It ties the hands, and some people will say rightly so. But it ties the hands of elected officials in Sacramento about what part of the general fund goes towards.
Yeah, that's true. But the educators have always been willing to give up some when the state needs it. And as a matter of fact, the full requirements of Proposition 98 have not been observed in times of fiscal stress, and those have been the last couple of years. So, yeah, it's very important that we find more money for schools, but I wouldn't say that any provision shouldn't be examined in a very careful, meticulous way.
Well, I guess this is the perfect time to ask you then more about taxes and about revenue, because again, finding more money for schools, but also this notion that, as you said in the announcement, you said again here, no taxes in this economy without a vote of the people. That's a paraphrase of what you said in the video announcement. Not sure I know what that means exactly. I don't want to parse words too badly, but does that mean that you'd solve the current, like, $20 billion problem with just cuts?
That's where we start. And we don't expect it to be finished in 12 months. It's going to take several years. It's taken a long time to get into this fiscal hole. It will take a long time to climb out. And we want to prune government back, but we want to be realistic. We want to think about how important our schools and our firefighting and our police are. All those are important. So, yes, this is going to be a process that is not going to be easy. But when people are out of work, losing their homes, I'm not going to be saying you ought to be paying more taxes.
But so is it just – I mean, what else could you do then if you're not going to raise taxes?
Well,
there's taxes and cuts.
Well, what have we done in the last couple of years? We've had to borrow, and we're going to have to use financing to get us through the next couple of years. But it has to be financing in the context of a serious workout where we see where the two government spending and government revenue come into balance.
One of the ones that gets talked about with Democrats a lot is the vehicle license fee. You know, Governor Schwarzenegger rolled that back. It had gone back up. It was lowered during the Wilson administration. Should that stay where it is? Should that stay lower, speaking of taxes?
I'm not prepared to offer any taxes because the people are so hard-pressed. And I've said no taxes without a vote of the people, and I mean that.
Oil severance tax. How about
same
that
thing.
Same
I
thing.
Mean, By the way, a lot of these things do take a vote of the people because they're locked into the Constitution. We have to engage the people in this problem. It's not enough for legislators that enjoy less than 20% confidence and trust on the part of the people. This is going to have to be a very public process, and the people in the final analysis will decide exactly how we fashion this long-term budget solution.
But would you be advocating for them in any way, shape, or form?
I'm
advocating. Because Governor Schwarzenegger advocated, obviously, for Prop 1A last year that had taxes in. And I know you say the people would ultimately speak, but as the man who would be governor.
We just had a recent election, and the vote was no. No to more taxes, no to more tax extensions. Now, I want to start the process and engage the Republicans in a way they've never been engaged, along with the Democrats, and let the people really understand what's at stake, what's waste, what's bone marrow, and how should we best handle it. And I don't think that is the product of one mind. It's going to be the collective undertaking of the legislature and the people of California.
And you know the conservatives think there's a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse in state government. And you're going to hear that from the whichever opponent comes out of the Republican primary. Do you think that's true?
I'm going to ask them for each item of waste and abuse. And, yeah, we're going to find things. I've cut over 750 positions from the Office of Attorney General. I've reduced our general fund spending by $100 million. Yeah, we can cut back, but we have to cut back not rhetorically, not as a political bomb thrower, but in a serious process of engagement with the Republicans and the Democrats, their supporters, and the people themselves over an extended period of time. We'll come up with the right answer.
A couple of other issues that I think people will be curious how you stand on. Environmental issues obviously are big in California. You've touched on a little bit of that as Attorney General. For example, the notion of what to do about CEQA, which we know is California's landmark environmental regulation law. You've suggested in some ways, because of the way it interacts with projects around the state, maybe it slows them down somehow. Might it need to be tweaked in some way?
Oh, sure.
Has it been abused?
Oh, well, yeah, it's been abused. It was abused in Oakland when people tried to stop projects that I promoted, a project right across from my warehouse where my campaign headquarters is, was stopped by some neighborhood activists, and I think wrongly stopped. And finally, it was built, but at more expense and with great delay. So, yeah, it takes 9 years to put up a transmission line. We can't bring solar and geothermal electricity from the desert unless we have transmission lines. We've got to cut back the regulatory underbrush, and I will take a backseat to no one in that effort. My hunch is that we have to transcend our political origins and forge a common undertaking, Californians first. That's what I see.
You seem excited.
I am.
You are.
It's a very exciting undertaking to take over so many years after I did it before, but with a lot more knowledge and insight and appreciation for both the difficulties and the fantastic dynamism of California and its people.
Jerry Brown, thanks for the time.
Thank you.